somebody asked last time about what column D was doing in that table in the chapter we were doing, and so I went through, and what column D is doing is illustrating the coast plus the goo is too much argument. It's showing a situation where the efficient solution is not to stop the sparks at all, but you're using a fine rather than a damage payment. And the result is that if the railroad company puts on the spark arrestor, it can both end the fine and get paid by the farmers to put on the spark arrestor. The sum of those payments is larger than the cost of the spark arrestor, and so it puts it on even though its value is less than its cost. And that's what that column was doing. I had forgotten. In fact, I'd forgotten that that whole table was there. I haven't been using it in teaching the course in recent years. So, as usual, let's start by seeing whether people have questions about what we did last time, and then go on from there. Are there any points last time that you're still finding puzzling or wanted to comment on or expand on or anything of that sort? No. All right. Very brief summary of what we were doing last time is that what the Coasean analysis tells you about setting up rules is that you pick the starting point, the rule you use, on the basis of how likely it is to give the efficient result and how easy it is to change the result if you get it wrong. So if you think of each of those rules sort of leads directly to certain results and only with some difficulty to others, and you want to say, all right, if the right outcome is this, can we get there easily? If the right outcome is that, can we get there easily? If the right outcome is that, can we get there easily? Well, no. How hard will it be to get there? Can we set things up so the transaction costs of getting that, if that's the right outcome, aren't too high? And then you basically imagine averaging the cost of getting to the right outcome and the cost of not getting to the right outcome, the inefficiency from throwing sparks when it's inefficient to throw sparks, say, you average that over all the cases your legal rule will apply to and pick the rule for which that's minimum. That's the underlying idea of what you're trying to do. The article by Coase is in part his analysis of externalities, showing them as a joint causation problem. In part, the point that we really don't have any do-nothing option, that laissez-faire isn't really defined because any laissez-faire is given some set of property rules, and there are different possible property rules. And that of the alternative ways of dealing with this problem, it is likely that none of them works perfectly, that you have a choice among different imperfect alternatives, which include what we're inclined to call the Coasean alternative, which is to find rights and let people bargain over them. It includes the alternative of combining activities in a single firm so that you've got one actor or one organization that's taking account of costs and benefits because they're all received by it. My example was the mall that we're all familiar with. The alternative of government regulation and the alternative of doing nothing at all because all ways of solving the problem end up worse than not solving it. And those are all possible responses to externality problems. Something I don't think I discussed really, but probably should have, is that among the other possible rules, other than the ones that I discussed, there are also rules of majority or supermajority for group decisions. So you can imagine a legal rule where the farmers can enjoin the sparks, but have to pay the cost, but they enjoin it by majority vote, and then they all have to pay the cost. Or you can imagine a system where some decision is made that requires a two-thirds majority. And one real-world interesting example of that you may be familiar with is the unitization of oil fields. Anybody know anything about that? The problem is the following. The very straightforward sort of externality kind of problem. Here is a pool of underground oil. Above it, there are a bunch of property owners, each owning a chunk of property over it. And the oil has been discovered. And so this property owner drills a hole down and starts pumping oil. What happens when he starts pumping oil? All right, oil fills. So this property owner, aware of this, says to himself, wait a minute, why should he get all my valuable oil? So he drills a well. And this guy says, wait a minute, you guys are doing it? And so you get four wells where one will do. And it turns out that the
physics, as it were, of extracting oil is that when you extract it faster, you get less because you're using gas pressure typically to push the oil out, and extracting it fast, basically you waste that, some of that. And the obvious solution is to find some way of getting all four of them to work together, drill one hole and divide up the profits. That's called unitization. It's done under state law in various states. And the typical rule is one in which some supermajority, say two-thirds, of the landowners above the oil pool have to agree, at which point the land is still private property, but the oil is now the joint property of all the owners. And there are, I don't know the details, but there are basically rules under which they then make decisions about pumping it, and they then get to divide up the royalties. Yep.
What's that called again?
Unitization. Because you're, instead of treating this as his property, his property, and his property, and his property, you're treating it as a single legal object, and that'd be the whole pool.
Right.
But that's interesting just because it provides a real-world example of a different class, as it were, a different sort of legal rule for dealing with some of these problems. And you can see that for some cases that's a sensible rule, but you should also see that it also raises problems. Because what are some of the problems that that legal rule is likely to raise? To begin with, what are we going to argue about when we start this unitization process?
How much of the oil belongs to whom?
One question is how do we divide it up? One question is who has a claim?
That. My house is here,
and everybody knows you can do slant drilling. So I claim I get to a share of the pool, too. And of course, it's not like you can actually see the pool, so we may have real arguments about where that pool is going. And then you may also have disagreement with how to use it. You may have some people who say, pump slowly, I want this to pay for my retirement in my old age. Other people say, I really need the money now. Furthermore, the pumping itself is going to be costly. And if I can get, say, a majority vote in whatever committee is deciding it, I allocate the pumping job to an oil company with relatively modest royalties, and in exchange they put some money in my Swiss bank account. That you can see there are lots of problems of that sort. What is the much more common problem of that same sort? What is the form of unitized property that is extraordinarily common in our society and that implicitly raises these problems? I mean, everybody is familiar with a bunch of people who are all the joint owner of valuable asset rather than individual owners. Stocks, of course. Joint stock corporation. And that's the same issues, right? You have a joint stock corporation, and one of the problems is how do you keep a group that manages to get a majority of the board of directors, which might not even be a majority of the stockholders, given a lot of stockholders don't vote. So how do you prevent some faction among the stockholders getting control of the corporation and using it to enrich themselves at the expense of the other stockholders? I don't know a lot about corporate law, but I gather that's one of the things the corporate law is designed to prevent, that you are not allowed to give dividends to some particular subset of stockholders and not all of them. You're not supposed to enrich yourself and so forth and so on. I don't know the details. My point is only that it raises really the same sort of issue where you're treating something as a pool jointly owned by a bunch of people. In this case, it's created not by unitization, but by people voluntarily putting in their money as buying initial issue stock. But once it's there, it raises the same issues of a commonly owned resource and the problems that it applies. All right. Any questions on that stuff before we go on to talk about insurance? Fine. All right. So, first question about insurance, which I hope I successfully answer in the chapter, is why it's in the book at all. And the answer is that one of the major things legal rules do is to allocate risk. And that's true of the legal rules that are made by courts. It's true of the rules inside a private contract, that one of the things you agree with when you sign a contract is if the price of inputs goes up a lot, do I or you pay for it? If you imagine you're building a house, is it
a cost plus deal, where if the price of the lumber used to build the house goes up, the house owner pays the extra cost, or is it a fixed price contract where if the price of the inputs go up, the result is the developer loses the money? All right, that's a risk allocation issue, and the issues we discussed in this chapter are going to be relevant. Similarly, if you think about tort law, that the think about those what economists would call efficient traffic accidents. What do you think an efficient traffic accident is? Given the way we've used these words before. Yep.
That if an accident occurs, take the necessary measures that it doesn't occur again.
No. That doesn't make the accident efficient. Let's put it differently. In an efficient system, what will the rate of traffic accidents be? More or less than zero? More or equal to zero?
More
than zero. Why will it be more than zero?
Just, I guess, efficient accident would be where the cost of preventing that accident is equal to the cost of it.
Is at least as great. An efficient accident is an accident where the cost of preventing is at least as great as the damage done, and therefore it's not worth preventing it. And that's sort of one of the many ways in which the economist's way of looking at the world seems weird to somebody else. So we don't need, what's the optimal number of traffic accidents? Oh, I don't know, say 50,000 a year or something. And that sounds, though, it means we're better off having traffic accidents than not, but it really means we're better off having the traffic accidents than not having them and having the cost we would have to bear in order to prevent them, such as not driving. So let's suppose, think about traffic accidents as efficient traffic accidents, inefficient traffic accidents. If the legal rule is strict liability, then the driver, a little difficult for traffic accidents because there are maybe two cars, but think about cars versus pedestrians, say. If it's strict liability for drivers, then the risk of the efficient accidents is being put on the driver, even though that isn't going to prevent them because they're efficient, therefore it still costs too much, as well as the risk of the inefficient one, which he can't prevent. If the rule is negligence, now the risk of the inefficient accidents is on the driver, but the risks of the efficient accidents is on the pedestrian. Make sense? Similarly, there's a category of unavoidably hazardous materials. There's a case that I always annoys me. This is a case which I regard as judicial incompetence of a level that should have been actionable, except that judges are shielded from such things. And it involved the live polio vaccine. I don't know if we discussed it here or not, but the relevant starting point was it was agreed that the live polio vaccine was unavoidably hazardous. This is before they had the newer vaccine. And that with the old vaccine, something like 1 in a million people who got immunized would get had polio as a result. It was agreed that simply that did not automatically make the vaccine manufacturer reliable when they got polio. That's a decision about risk allocation. Right? You have an unlikely day out of that. Do you say the polio manufacturer bears the risk or the patient who gets immunized bears the risk? Or putting it differently, does polio vaccine come with an insurance policy? So all of these are really insurance issues in effect. And then economics of insurance. First, it's the context in which a lot of these ideas were originally worked out. And second, it provides for us an easy way of sort of getting it at the ideas. So it is useful, I think, to start with the questions, basically, of why you do get insured and why you don't. And what's the basic reason for being insured?
Why buy insurance or why things?
Why do you buy insurance? Why does it make sense to buy insurance? Often, not always, of course. You know that assuming the insurance company is confident, you're losing money on the gamble. Right? Assuming that they are confident, if your house has one chance in 100 of burning down and it's a $100,000 house, they are going to charge you something more than $1,000 a year in insurance. Right? Because otherwise they wouldn't be able to pay their rent and salaries. So if you think of it as a Las Vegas gamble, it's a bad gamble. You're paying more than $1,000 for a bet that has an expected value of $1,000. Why do you do it?
Because
Well, I mean, I think as you described it, you're basically trading relatively cheap dollars in a safe future you're trading that for dollars that would mean a lot to you
right.
in the future in which that occurs.
Yep. Yes, that's right. Low-value dollars in the future where you're well off being traded for high-value dollars in the future where you're badly off, and you're willing to pay a premium to do that. That's the, I think, useful way. And that's called risk aversion. And I discuss in the book why I am somewhat unhappy with that term, because I don't see any inconsistency in the guy who buys fire insurance but likes skydiving as a hobby. And people, I mean, there are a lot of these problems where you have a term like risk aversion, which sounds self-explanatory, and people never think about what it really means as a result. And really, you know, we all know sort of it's sort of scary to have a risk, but that's not really what risk aversion is about. And that what risk aversion is about is what you were just describing, which economists refer to as the declining marginal utility. The idea that as a general rule, with some exceptions, the more dollars you have, the less the value you owe one more dollar. And and again, not only does it not mean that you don't like skydiving, it also doesn't mean that you wouldn't take that you would be willing to take a negative expected return gamble in something other than money, because there might be something else, as in my example, years of life, which had rising utility. And you could imagine cases where dollars did. My standard example of increasing marginal utility is tires on your car. The benefit from getting the fourth tire is higher than the benefit from getting the third tire. So it's not as if it's inevitable. But if you imagine the kind of thing that's true more of money than of tires, where you, as it were, are using it for separable purposes. First I buy something here, then something not quite as valuable here, then something a little less valuable here, and so forth. In that context, it makes logical sense that you spend the first dollars on the most important things and the other dollars on less. And it's only when you have sort of non-separable purchases, when you've got something where something I desperately want that costs $100,000 and $90,000 just won't do it, that you might get the answer. So then the next side of that is the question of why you wouldn't buy insurance, and the first answer to that, we really have two, is moral hazard. And my guess is that that term predates the modern sense of moral as being about morality. My guess is that it was using moral in a sense closer to our word morale, meaning a hazard that comes not from physical things, but from people's incentives. There's a quote from Napoleon that in war, the moral is to the physical in the ratio of 3-1, I think it is. Of course, it would have been in French, so they translated it as that, where I think he meant that psychological characteristics, such as whether your troops expect to win or to lose, are more important than the physical details of how good your guns are, who's got the high ground, and so forth. But in any case, moral hazard is the costs that are the result of rational, self-interested behavior, given that you've got insurance. All right, and the problem is a simple enough problem. I run through it in the book. I'm really just duplicating stuff, but if you want to ask any questions, I guess that's what I got to do. And the problem is that risks can be to some extent controlled, that I can decide what precautions to take to keep my million-dollar factory from burning down, and what is an efficient fire in my factory, in the sense that we just know, what would it mean if I said, oh, that was an efficient fire? What does that mean?
The fire that cost the cost was greater than the cost of preventing the fire.
No, well, the efficient fire is only the cost of the preventing it is larger than the cost of the fire. So that you can imagine, let us suppose for a moment that, I don't know what this is, that is not from my class. I was there when my class started this afternoon. So let's imagine that we have a $1 million factory. Maybe the $10 billion. I'm not sure if there are factories that are as cheap as $1 million nowadays. $10 million factory. And spend nothing on precautions. It has a 4% chance of burning down each year. And that's a net cost of 4% of that is $400,000, right? Yes. So that's a cost, expected cost, the factory burning down at $400,000. If I spend $50,000 on precautions on a sprinkler system, that lowers it to 3% expected cost of $300,000. So that first set of precautions, that sprinkler system is worth getting, cost me $50,000, saving me $100,000. If I spend $140,000, I can get it down to 2%, $200,000. Is that worth spending? Yes, it cost me $90,000, saved me $100,000. If I spend $250,000, I can get it down to 1%. No way of getting below that is my imaginary case. Should I do that? No, $110,000 cost, $100,000. So therefore, the fires that occur if I'm taking this level of precaution are, yep.
Well, that makes sense if you make each of these decisions sequentially. But let's assume he's deciding what.
Sorry, just each of these is.
Right.
What, yeah.
Right. So if he says that, so, if he's starting with no precautions, and he looks at.
But the fire in the factory is just about to open, and I'm deciding what level of precautions.
Right. But it does make sense to him, right? What? To go from zero to 250 because you're saving 300. Right.
Yes, but I could save more than that by going from zero to 140.
Okay. Right. Okay.
So.
But it's still, right, okay, so relatively inefficient.
If the only choice
is zero, right,
was this, yeah, or this, then this, right, would be the efficient outcome.
Right, okay.
Given this set of choices, this is inefficient.
Yeah.
Because going from year to year is a net loss.
Right. Right.
So therefore, if he spends $140,000, the fires still occur, efficient fires, in my sense. Suppose, however, that. Maybe easy case. Suppose he insures for 100%. Which of these precautions does this take?
Yep.
None of them, because somebody else has lost, not his loss. So the result is that there's a chance, and leaving aside the insurance company's rent and salary, just thinking about it in terms of the gamble, how much the insurance company can get it. The charge to insure him his $10 million factory for 100%. It's got 4% chance each year of burning down.
Something over that.
They're going to charge at least $400,000, right? So let's call it $400,000 plus. $400,000 would be the actuarially fair sum, but doesn't allow either for the value to him of reduced risk or to the cost to them of running an insurance company. So something over $400,000. Suppose. Now, can you see that there is a sense in which this is an inefficient outcome? Inasmuch as he is failing to take precautions, which would make him on net $60,000 better off. All right?
Is that clear?
Except that they wouldn't. They'd make the insurance company. In fact, they make the insurance company $200,000 better off than him $140,000. Or something. So he's not dead. So that's a dead weight cost. That's a cost. He gets a benefit from the insurance, the risk aversion, but he has a real cost in that, putting it differently, he is now spending $400,000 a year, at least. Whereas if he weren't insured at all, he would be spending, on the average, $340,000 a year. Right? With no insurance, he has $200,000 on average of losses, $140,000 of precautions, $340,000. So in that sense, he is worse off for the insurance. Actuarially, he's worse off. On average, he'd be.
Suppose, however, he only insured for 80%. Right? So, putting it differently, this is the insurance, and this is the cost to him. And in the 100% insurance, the only cost to him is the insurance, because he's never going to lose his factory, right? So the cost to him is always 400,000. How about 80%? What happens to 80% insurance? How much are they going to charge for 80% insurance?
No precautions to be 20 plus.
What?
With no precautions to be 20 plus.
I didn't say it. They are deserving of precautions.
Okay.
We can get to that later. But at this point, they are predicting precautions because they can work out the logic of this just the weekend, but they aren't actually seeing what they're doing. So let's put it differently. With 80% insurance, what precautions do they take? Yeah. Hey, I shouldn't have used 80%. Sorry. The numbers I've gotten. I should have made the first one a better deal than it was. Let's make it, sorry, I should have set this up with someone different than I meant, but this will do. Make it 40% insurance, all right? With 40% insurance, what cost is the take? 40% insurance means he's paying 60% of the loss if the factory goes down, so what's he do? Because it's based on $60,000, right? There's a $100,000 loss. He pays 60% of it. That's a $60,000 loss. So he's paying $50,000 in precaution to save himself $60,000. Make sense? Right? No.
So one more time, please.
Sure. He had a choice. He could take no precautions. If he takes, remember, the insurance company is going to charge whatever it's going to charge. They aren't looking at his precautions. They're predicting his precautions, but they aren't actually observing it. So therefore, from his standpoint, he pays whatever he pays for insurance. And he then either pays $50,000 for precautions and loses $40,000 a year for the uninsured part of his factory. No, loses $60,000 a year. No, sorry. If he pays the $50,000, then that's only a $300,000. Then it's only a 3% chance, only 300,000, so he pays, so it's 12,000. Is that right? I think that's right. If he takes these precautions, pays 50,000 for the precautions, he loses 300,000 a year, which he's paying 60%. So 300,000, 60%, that's 18,000, isn't it? Did I make a mistake? Pays 50,000 and then 60% of,
would it be 180,000?
Yeah, I think you're right. You are correct.
Yeah.
Thank you. 180,000 plus 50,000 equals 250,000. Alternatively, he can choose not to take the precautions and he then is paying 60% of 400,000, right? Because then the chance of burning down is 4%. 60% of 400,000 is 240,000. So he's better off taking it. Is that right? Good. So he's going to take the precautions. And having taken the precautions, now his net cost on this deal is that which is 230,000. Plus the cost of the insurance. And the insurance, if it's at its actuarial value, the insurance company realizes he will take that precaution because they can work out the logic the same way we have. So they say there's a 3% chance of the factory burning down. That's 300,000. We're insuring 40% of that, so that's 120,000. So that's plus 120,000 in insurance. So it's a total of 350,000 is his cost to him this week. Calculated correctly, which I've not had. All right, but I think I have. Because
What does that tell us? It tells us that by cutting his insurance from 100% to 40%, or indeed from anything above 50 to 40, his total cost on average goes down from 400 to 300. And that's right, because indeed that first set of precautions saved $50,000 on this. Right? Does that make sense? And so therefore, at this point, he's got more risk, so if he's risk averse, he might not do it. But from the standpoint of moral hazard, he is, and again, I'm here really assuming the insurance company is charging him the actuarial cost of getting these initial costs. But you can see here that he is better off on expected gambling terms with a lower level of insurance. Suppose we go all the way down to zero insurance. With zero insurance, what precautions does he take?
No precautions.
What?
No precautions.
With zero insurance.
Oh, 0%, that's right.
Zero insurance. He's bearing it off. He's uninsured. Which precaution does he take? Does he take this precaution? Does he have to take this precaution? Cost $50,000, then if it's $100,000, does he take it? Yeah, of course. Next one costs $90,000, then it's $100,000, does he take it? Next one costs $110,000, then it's $100,000, no, he's not. So, with no insurance, he's here. And what is his cost? It's $140,000 worth of precautions, plus a 2% chance of losing his factory, which is $200,000, which is a total of $340,000. So you're seeing in this example the effect of moral hazard, the fact that it results in an inefficiency due to the failure to take cost-effective precautions. But you can also see that going from here to here eliminates 50,000 of that inefficiency. Going from here to here, only 10,000 more. And why? Because when you're getting heavily insured, the precautions you're not taking that are worth taking are the ones that are really worth taking, right? Whereas when you drop from 40% to zero, even with 40% insurance, any precaution that was worth a lot more than this cost you were taking, right? It's only the precautions like this one here, which are worth a little bit more than their cost, that stop being worth taking when you're partially insured. Make sense? Doesn't make sense? Yeah.
What's the 340 represent?
The $340,000 is on average how much it's going to cost him to A, take precautions against fires, and B, have fires. So it's the sum of his precautions plus his fires. All right. And the point I'm trying to make here, one which comes up later, is that typically the inefficiency from having a lot of insurance instead of a little insurance is likely to be much bigger than the inefficiency of having a little insurance instead of no insurance. Because where is it coming from? It's coming from you're not taking precautions. Failing to take a precaution that costs $9 and is worth $10 doesn't lose you very much. Failing to take a precaution that costs $2 and is worth $10 loses you a lot. But the high level of insurance is the one that keeps you from taking even the really good precautions. And the low level only keeps you from taking the precautions that are barely worth taking. So it's a point that's relevant because one of the practical solutions to this problem is the compromise of getting only partially insured. That if you're insured at only 50%, you've got to instead take most of the important, well, in this case at 49%, most of the important precautions, and you're covered against about half your risk. All right? Yes?
So how do you, I guess you sort of explain why
people get
insurance.
We just did, by risk aversion.
So let's assume an insurance model where the insurance company demands, as part of the insurance contract, that you take these precautions.
That's another solution.
But you bear the expense. At that point, does it still make sense to buy insurance? How would you analyze it?
Sure. Yes, so they may say, if they can observe it, it makes more sense to buy insurance now. Because now you've eliminated the moral hazard. Right? If they can really tell what precautions you ought to take and what precautions you're taking, then all the inefficiency goes away and you can get
your 100% insurance and that no moral hazard at all. Right. Much better deal.
But you may, right, but you may be, I mean, but would that include potentially inefficient precautions like the last one?
We've got two different cases. One of the cases, they say, here are the precautions you must take in order for us to insure you. And in that case, they're not going to include that last one because that one is...
Doesn't make sense. Okay.
If you imagine, if you were foolish enough to sign a contract which said, here is what we'll pay for insurance. The insurance company tells us what precautions we have to take and we have to pay for it. Then you pay them to tell you that last precaution because you'd be paying for it and they get it. But that's not the way you would do it.
Right.
Yeah. Yes?
I guess probably what happens in the real world would be insurance companies lobby the government to require people to take certain precautions.
That's one possibility. Okay. The other one is their contracts. If you go, the problem is the enforceability problem in both cases, whether by government or by private. Look, you go into a place that fixes automobiles. What does the sign say over the door from the office into the workshop? You never observed this?
Customers aren't allowed in.
Customers aren't allowed into the workshop, of course. Why do you think the sign says that? That, my guess, is the insurance requires it. And that explains both why the sign says it and why they don't enforce it. All right. Now, it may be partly that the insurance company doesn't care if they enforce it. The insurance company may figure the sign is enough so they won't be liable if you do go in, you can put on notice. But it could also be that the insurance company believes they still can get sued and want them to enforce it, but the insurance company doesn't have a guy standing in the door to watch. So that insofar as the insurance company can tell what the precautions are and can tell if you're taking them, that's a wonderful solution to this problem. But it might be they couldn't tell if you're taking them. It might also be they don't know what they are. Imagine, for example, that the real precaution is when you're hiring workers, going to a good deal of trouble to figure out which are the ones who are irresponsible people who are likely to smoke next to piles of paper and so forth. That's going to be costly to you. It means you're going to have to pay more for your workers. You won't get people who are good, hardworking people but are really careless. Very hard for the insurance company to observe that. But if you are bearing the cost, you can observe it. So that's why your solution, although a perfectly good solution, has got its real limitations. So we have at this point two different solutions to this problem. One of them is the insurance company imposing and monitoring precautions, and the other is co-insurance. The other is you're getting only partially insured in order that you have at least most of the incentive you need, the incentive to avoid all except the sort of marginal precautions.
All right.
Yes?
So then it would seem that 100% insurance then would preclude the company owner from taking precautions that neither of them know about at the time, right? Some sort of creative solution to fix something that they didn't know about because he's covered 100%.
Right.
So it could be something that's incredibly efficient, but he's never even going to look into fixing it because he's covered.
But the counter argument could be that the insurance company is much more likely to know about such things than he is because they, after all, are in the business of preventing fires. That's a point I haven't gotten to yet. It's in the chapters here. You're familiar with it. And, of course, at 110 or 120% insurance, the risk gets really high. My favorite Kipling poem is a poem called The Merry Gloucester. And it's... Are any of you familiar with any of the Browning monologues, of which My Last Duchess is the most famous one? Browning was a 19th century poet, and one of the things he did was to write some very famous poems in which you've got a single person speaking, and the person is revealing things about himself, not necessarily intentionally by what he's saying. And there is a Browning monologue written not by Browning, but by Kipling, which I think is better than Browning's. And the speaker is a self-made shipping millionaire, 19th century, talking to his worthless son while he's dying, basically. And he's describing his early career. Dad, what ships I've handled, rotten and leaky and old, ran them or opened the bilge pipe. Precisely as I was told. Crews that'd drive you crazy and grub that'd turn you gray and a big fat lump of insurance to cover the risk on the way. And pretty clearly he's discussing some cases where you let your ship sink in order to collect the insurance. That's the moral hazard issue. And then the point that I've... And you can see it in lots of other examples. If you think about Think about health insurance, because it actually can go both ways. Think first about the health insurance where you get to decide how often you go to the doctor and whether you have operations and what treatment you get. And now what's moral hazard going to consist of? It's a form of insurance. The cost of your going to the doctor is being borne by the insurance company, not by you.
Lifestyle decisions.
That would be a further step, but I was going to take the much shorter, much more immediate step, which is that anytime you've got a, you have a cold, you go to see the doctor. As long as you think there's any significant, as long as the chance of being helped makes up for the hour it takes to go see the doctor, you're going to do it. Even in those cases where almost certainly you should wait for, you know, drink lots of fluids, get lots of bed rest, you'll be fine tomorrow kind of cases, but it takes the doctor's expensive time. So that would be sort of the simplest level of the problem. Reverse the problem. Suppose the insurance company makes all decisions. Now the insurance company, except for maybe perhaps some reputational concerns, but at least again in the sort of simple short run case, well, all right, your fever is 103 and you're coughing your lungs out, go to bed, get lots of fluids, get a good night's sleep, and call us in the morning. Right? That is the same problem the other way around. That if the person who is bearing the cost is not bearing, he's not, if the decision is made by someone who doesn't bear all the costs, he has an incentive to neglect those costs. He doesn't bear. But you're right about the lifestyle thing as well. You can easily enough imagine the person who says, well, suppose we were pre-AIDS but post antibiotics. The person who says, you know, why should I wear a condom? If I, you know, get a disease, I'll go to the doctor and, you know, it takes a few weeks of antibiotics and I'm better again. Well, and you can think of a lot of other cases of that general sort. You know, if you're thinking about some sport which is hazardous, and you know, I decided about a year ago that 64 was too old for sword and shield fighting. After I managed to straighten my leg, just limping around for some months. So all of those things are potential ones. What about students? Let's think about it not in terms of insurance, but it's something that's really logically very similar. Suppose you take out an insurance, a student loan. And the terms of the student loan are that what they get is a share of your salary. I'm not sure if there are any in those forms. You can certainly imagine a loan that says, look, we want to be fair. We don't want to penalize people who are, you know, doing good, publicly useful jobs at a low pay by making them pay back $300,000. So what we'll do is we'll say, you owe us 20% of your income for the next 20 years, and we'll set the percentage so on average we can pay back. That's one possibility for the student loan. What's the problem with that? What are the two problems with that? 20% isn't enough. We should take 20%. Where is moral hazard going to show up there?
What are the terms?
Only
if you work at a certain...
Whatever you do.
So, I mean,
whatever you do, we take 20% of your income.
There's a disincentive to advance up the career ladder.
That is to say, you've got a choice between two jobs. And one of them, you know, you're going to be working 11 hours a day, 6 days a week, and it's going to be high stress, people shouting at each other. But the upside of it is that if you perform well, you're going to be making $150,000 in a couple of years. Well, maybe, but $120,000 might not do it, and that's the difference because, and of course, there's income tax as well, but I was just taking this particular Fed. So there's going to be a lower incentive to trade other values for money, basically. But all of these have the same feature. In fact, it's also a problem with income tax. So in income tax, the standard cost, as it were, the net cost of the income tax, it doesn't just take money from A to give it to B. It also gives A an incentive not to produce money. Or if he produces money, to figure out ways of producing it in non-taxable forms. But those are all sort of related issues that are all really moral hazard of But then the flip side of it, the one for which I've coined the term that sometimes moral hazard is a feature rather than a bug, is the argument that sometimes you're transferring the cost to someone who can control it better than you can. And that goes back to your solution to the insurance problem. Let's suppose not only that the insurance company can tell you what precautions to take, but that the insurance company has got people who are sort of the world's leading experts and what precaution to take. Because after all, they're insuring 1,000 factories with a total value of $10 billion. And with that amount of money, they can afford to do research on what the cost of different precautions are and on what sprinkler systems are better and more cost effective and on whether or how to enforce rules against smoking on the job and stuff like that. All right. So if they're really the experts, then maybe the best thing to do is to say, insure for 100%. Tell me before I sign the contract what precautions I have to take so I know what they're going to cost me, but then you decide on the precautions. So that would be a case where you were transferring the risk, but you're transferring the risk to someone who can better control it than you can. All right? Which is what I think I was putting the incentive where it does the most good. Can you see from what we said before what might be a still better rule than that? Because let us consider that in the real world, it's true that the company is expert in preventing fires, but it's also true that some of the things for preventing fires are things you can control and they can't, the ones they can't observe, we discussed before. So what might be the best rule of all here? You insure for a sizable fraction to give them an incentive, but not for all of it to give you an incentive. Neither of you has the perfect incentive, but now most of you have most of the incentive. So that looks like a fairly attractive solution to that. And I discuss in the book two other examples of the same feature, one of which is relevant to most of us and suggests that I've usually made the wrong choice. I'm not sure if that suggestion is right or not, one of which isn't. And the one that isn't relevant to most of us is the large corporation with 1,000 factories. And there the problem is that a corporation has all sorts of internal problems of A, making decisions that B pays for. All right? That's in such one of the reasons, the disadvantage, one of the reasons we don't solve all externality problems by lumping everything into one firm is all of the problems of getting people in a firm to do the right thing, given that they're not the ones who are actually paying the cost or getting the benefits. And so similarly, in the example I discussed in the chapter, you have 1,000 factories, you've got an employee who manages one of those factories, and the employee says to himself, what is the cost if the factory burns down? $10 million nonsense. I don't have $10 million. The cost of the factory burns down is I get fired. And that's a cost to me of $1 million, say, or maybe less than $1 million. So it's a pretty sensible gamble, isn't it, for me to skimp on precautions, thus making my bottom line look really good, and with luck in a year or two I'll get promoted to a better job, to a better position in my company, and I'm taking a 4% chance of getting fired as against a 96% chance of getting promoted. Sounds like a good deal. Now, it's not a good deal for my company because they're for them it's a 4% chance of a $10 million loss. So the company might say, we see this problem exists, so instead of having decisions made by our manager, we'll have them made by the insurance company. All right. That's one reason why you might choose to insure that it has nothing to do with risk aversion, because the big company isn't risk averse. It can risk pool across its factories. And the second example, the one that's relevant to us, is contracts when you buy appliances and things where the seller agrees to pay for repairs, where I never buy them. And I may well be mistaken. That's sort of this is an old habit from the obvious argument, which is the sums involved are small compared to my total worth, therefore I'm not risk averse with regard to them, so why should I lose money? And I'm less and less sure of that the more I think of this argument, which suggests that Sears are simply more competent to make sure their stuff gets repaired than I am. So those are all examples where you can think of moral hazard, as I say, as a feature rather than a bug. Do people still use that phraseology? Feature versus bug. It's sort of from software.
Jargon. My roommate in undergrad was a computer science person. He used it all the time.
Yes.
Way too much.
I remember seeing a description of a very old computer game console that I used to own two of, where somebody says, it was so old that it goes back to where cheat codes were called bugs. And called Vectrex. It looked like a small version of the original Macintosh in terms of shape. And it did its pictures with vector graphics rather than bitmap graphics, for those of you who understand the distinction. So it viewed a picture as line from here to here rather than as dot, dot, dot. And it was lots of fun. And the later bit of the Vectrex story is that many, many years after it had gone off the market, I was browsing around the internet on Usenet, which is a what looks like a huge collection of bulletin boards, although it's really decentralized. And I discovered there was a Vectrex user group. And these were people who, like me, had thought this was a really fun game a long time ago, and even though it had been off the market for 10 or 15 years, they were still playing it and talking about it and so forth. And someone on the Vectrex user group had raised the question of whether some of them could burn copies of their game cartridges for other people to use. But there was obviously a copyright problem. And someone managed to locate the copyright holder for the Vectrex games. And he wrote him, and he said, "You know, do you mind?" And it was pretty clear that the copyright holder was the original inventor, designer, engineer. And he was so happy that here people were still playing with his toy. Of course you can make copies. Would you like to write some new games? I shall have the software. And I just thought it was sort of a charming way example of the way in which modern technology sometimes produces attractive human results, getting together people with a common interest who were dispersed, you know, across the globe, or at least across America, maybe more than America, and who, in this case, got to meet each other. But that's a... I wondered, by the way, sort of economics of other human institutions as to whether the internet is going to eventually destroy science fiction fandom. Because the energy of science fiction fandom, in my view as an economist, came from gains from trade. And the gains from trade are, suppose you're the author of a moderately successful science fiction novel. All right? From the standpoint of your neighbors, you're nobody of any importance. You're not particularly rich, you're not particularly famous, you're sort of, yeah, one more neighbor. But somewhere out there, there are 20,000 people who think you're just wonderful, your readers, your fans. It's really nice meeting people who think you're wonderful. It's really nice being able to have dinner with some wonderful person who wrote that book you like so much you want to talk about. So therefore, a science fiction convention was producing gains from trade by putting together the author and the fans. And the question is whether the internet, which allows any fan to write an email to any author he feels like it, and in my experience quite often get an answer, is going to, as it were, suck the blood out of the dynamics of that particular social institution. Anyway, this has nothing to do with law and economics. It has nothing to do with economics, because economics is about human behavior in general, and that is a real gain from trade. So, let me go on to... Let me first point out that the co-insurance is really related to our Coasean double causation problem, because double causation is where you've got two people whose actions cause the problem, and ideally you want both of them to take precautions, and what's the best you can do? Let me go on to the other problem, which is adverse selection, which is sort of traditionally in the insurance literature the other inefficiency that's associated with insurance. And adverse selection, the basic problem is not that insurance makes you worse, but that some people don't get insured who should. All right? And the reason is that you have asymmetric information. And asymmetric information is a situation where one of two parties to a contract or to a transaction knows more about the facts relevant to the price for that transaction than the other one does. And the famous example from Akerlof is his article, The Market for Lemons, where he's looking at the used car market. And if, for simplicity, you have two kinds of cars, lemons, which are cars that are in really bad shape, but it's not obvious, and cream puffs, which are cars that are in really good shape, but it's not obvious, they're all secondhand cars. And if you own a car, how is the price that you're willing to accept for it affected by whether it's a cream puff or a lemon? To accept. You're a potential seller. You say, "I'm thinking of replacing my car. I don't have to replace the car. It still runs. Even the lemon still runs. It may not run very well, and I always run, but it runs." And so let's suppose you're the owner. And you say, "Boy, is this car a lemon. If anybody gives me $5,000 for it, it's theirs." Suppose the car were a cream puff, what would you say?
Sell for much
more. $5,000? Yes. Running very well. Sell for $5,000. Maybe at $10,000 I'd be willing to sell it. But that's the owner's values. Let us suppose the potential buyer is a potential buyer because he wants to get the car. The car is
more valuable to him than the seller. So let us suppose that his that he would be willing to give 12,000 to the club and 6,000 to them. All right. The only problem is that the owner knows whether the car is a cream puff and the buyer doesn't. So you're the buyer. And let's suppose it just so happens that of the cars that people are thinking of selling, 50% are lemons and 50% are cream puffs. So you're a buyer, and looking at that, what are you willing to offer for a car? If you ask the seller, is it a lemon or a cream puff, what's he going to tell you? Of course, beautiful car, wonderful car. I'm only getting rid of it because I got this great buy on a new car, right? So what are you as a buyer willing to offer given that you don't know whether it's a cream puff or a lemon?
8,000. Well, I would get 8,000.
I don't know.
Would you offer
7,500? You? Yeah, yep. Would you feel like you're willing to get 6,000 out of risk?
That's only going to be the right answer, but I don't think the answer we want to start with yet. Okay. The first answer is you say, well, 50% either way. I'm willing to offer up to 9,000. You know, I'd like to get it for less than that. I'm willing to offer. The problem is that if you offer 9,000, what's going to happen? You're not going to get the cream puff because the guy won't sell the cream puff for 9,000. So either you don't get the car or you get a lemon. Pay 9,000 for a $6,000 car, not a cream. All right? So given the logic of those particular numbers, if your original answer is right, you will not be willing to offer more than 6,000. Because you say to yourself, as long as I offer less than 10,000, I'm going to get no cream puffs. If I offer 10,000, I'm going to get half cream puffs and half lemons. They aren't worth 10,000 to me. So therefore, all I can do is offer 6,000, or maybe if I'm clever, 5,100, and get 11 at lemon price. Right? Logic makes sense? Exactly the same problem, the same situation is going to exist if you're buying insurance. That this time the asymmetry is the other direction. It's the buyer, not the seller, who has the extra information, who knows whether he goes skydiving and who has or hasn't just discovered that the woman he's having an affair with is married to the local mafia boss, things like that. So therefore, in that case, we can make a cream puff. I have to reverse it. Reverse my numbers for a moment. And why am I reversing them? Because this time the question is, what's the cost of insuring somebody? Cream puff's the guy who's in great health. And the cream puff buyer says to himself, I'd be willing to pay up to $6,000 for life insurance, health insurance, whatever the insurance is he's buying. The lemon buyer says, I'm not long for this world. I'm willing to pay up to $12,000 to have $100,000, whatever it is worth of life insurance, to take care of my family. The seller says to himself, healthy people I'm willing to insure for $5,000, unhealthy people for $10,000. But this guy knows and this one doesn't, whether he's healthy or not. So if he says, just as before, if he says, well, on average, half of them are healthy, so I'm going to charge $7,500 for this insurance. $7,500. Sorry, the healthy guy says, take my chances. I'm not going to overpay that much for the insurance. Only worth $6,000 to me. All he gets are lemons, and then the insurance company is taking a $10,000 cost and being paid $7,500. Clear? Same logic as before. And so in this case, the inefficiency is not in incentives about taking precautions. The inefficiency is that the insurance is worth more to this guy than it costs, but he's not getting it. And he's not getting it because the very decision to buy is a signal that he is a bad risk. Not a perfect signal, but a signal. He therefore is being charged a bad risk price, and at a bad risk price, he is a good risk, doesn't want to buy. Right? Bottom of the problem there? Thank you.
That's what bone at risk selection is, I said. And my favorite modern example, because it's a real controversy where almost everybody ignores this argument, is the issue of genetic testing in insurance. Because if it's becoming increasingly possible to detect genetic characteristics that affect the chance of things like having a heart attack, my guess is it's not anywhere near good enough now for the problem that I'm just discussing in the book and discussing now to come in, but it could eventually. So suppose that the testing says that the genetic testing identifies you as a cream puff or a lemon from the standpoint of life insurance or health insurance, that you either have a set of genes that make you very likely to need hospitalization or to die and collect on your life insurance, or to make you very unlikely. And now the question is, what happens according to what the rules are about insurance companies? And to start with, given that that testing exists, what's the obvious thing for an insurance company to do? How does it eliminate the adverse selection problem and make it a perfectly ordinary case?
Does the insurance company know about the results or just know?
The insurance company knows the testing exists.
Okay.
And what would it be sensible for the insurance company then to do?
It would be sensible to charge at the limit price because people...
Why do you assume only if they can't tell? All of these are assuming that only one side knows. But if genetic testing exists, anybody can do it.
But if the testing exists, then it's more likely than not that the person who's going to buy insurance is going to be a lemon.
Absolutely true. But if you charge the same price to lemons and cream puffs. But if the testing exists, you don't have to charge the same price. Right? So what you can do instead is to say, we'll be glad to insure you. But if you don't mind, you know, go over into that office and we'll take a little swab from the inside of your cheek and send some cells to our lab and call you back tomorrow and give you the price of your insurance. All right? So, under those circumstances, there's no problem vis-a-vis adverse selection. But what might be seen as a problem is that you can no longer insure against bad genes any more than you could make a bet after rolling the dice. All right? So in that world, the risk of having a heart attack given your genes is insurable. But born with bad genes, sorry buddy, $12,000. Born with good genes, $6,000. Can't insure against that. Facts out there already. Right? And a lot of people regard that as unfair. And of course it is unfair in the sense in which life is unfair, right? And it's not nearly as unfair as the fact that all of us had the good luck to be born in one of the richest countries in the world in the richest century in history. But it still is unfair in the sense that you aren't responsible for your genes. And so a natural response, and one which may be current law, I wouldn't be surprised, certainly was urged by many people, is to make it illegal for the insurance company to require testing or to make its price conditional on testing. The insurance company can't ask for such a thing. Now we're back where you were before. All right. If we now have a world where you, as the purchaser, can have the genetic information, but the insurance company is not allowed to have it or to act on it, now they have to charge the same price to lemons and cream puffs. Now the cream puffs don't buy the insurance at that price. Now the price they're going to raise the lemon price, and now people with bad genes, nobody can insure against the risk of bad genes. Because they're going to assume you have bad genes when you buy the insurance. You can insure against residual risk if you have bad genes, but you can't insure against residual risk if you have good genes because they'll charge you a bad gene price. You can, but it'll be a lousy deal. Make sense? So, let's go back one step further. Before genetic testing. Before genetic testing, you can insure simultaneously against the genetic risk and the non-genetic. Because neither you nor the insurance company knows whether you're a cream puff or a lemon, and that's a solution to adverse selection, right? Adverse selection comes from asymmetric information. You can make the information symmetric either by destroying the expert's information or by giving it to the non-expert. In this case, nobody had the information. So in that respect, genetic testing makes the world worse. It means that there is a risk people would like to insure against which they can't insure against. Now, there is an even better solution, but it's probably not workable. Now, the even better one is if you can set things up so that you can prove to the insurance company that you haven't been tested. Because if you have some way of doing that, then you can buy your insurance before you're tested, thus insuring against the genetic risk. You can then get tested if you want and use that information in making other decisions about your life, knowing, you know, how careful you have to be about what you eat, things like that. But it would be very hard to enforce that rule in a world of many nations. And you can always go off somewhere else and get tested and not tell them about it. So it's an interesting case where improving our knowledge could make us worse off. Can you see what is the analogous case to this that's always existed? What is the risk, you might almost call it a genetic risk, that you can't insure against in a private insurance market and that we would like to insure against? The risk of being born poor. Right? There are all sorts of circumstances. Being born stupid, being born to poor parents, being born, you know, you have a whole lot of ways in which the way you come into the world affects how well you do thereafter. And you can't insure against them because you're already in the world when you buy insurance, and therefore you already know. And indeed, one argument for welfare policies is that they're the governmental equivalent of that insurance that you can't do. All right? That the argument, the utilitarian argument for income redistribution, there are utilitarian arguments against it. The utilitarian argument for is exactly the insurance argument. It says the dollar is more valuable to the poor person than to the rich person, and therefore we're on net better off transferring. And to take it to the insurance equivalent, there is the philosophical argument which says the right way of judging a society is to imagine you were being randomly placed in that society. Which one would you prefer? Well, if you're being randomly placed, you're like the person facing an insurable risk, and you would say, I'd rather have a world where, because of income redistribution, my income will be either 40,000 or 80,000, than one where it'll be either 10,000 or 120,000, even though the average is higher in the second case. Okay. Now, there are problems. The most fundamental problem with redistribution is rent-seeking. The fact that if you have political institutions for taking from one person and giving to another, everyone has an incentive to devote resources to making sure they're the ones who are given to, not the ones taken from. And that's a cost, and that might mean that the optimal level of redistribution is zero. That would be a fact-dependent question. But there is sort of this old economic argument for more equal incomes, which really parallels very closely the argument for why people buy insurance. Let me mention another historically important institution which raises many of the same issues, and that's sharecropping. People know what sharecropping is? Right. It's a form of rental in which the tenant pays the landlord some share of his crop. And economists for 100 years have said this is crazy. Look at the moral hazard. That after all, if I can get an extra $100 worth of crop with $90 worth of fertilizer, I'm not going to do it because you're getting half that crop. What ratio will depend on the particular contract. So it's obviously an inefficient rule. You should always have fixed rents instead. All right. The only trouble with that is that sharecropping is a very common institution in many unrelated societies. And it's very hard to believe that if it's clearly a stupid thing, if somebody would do it. And that then raises the interesting puzzle of what its function is. What's the most obvious guess about why sharecropping exists, given what I've just been saying? What do you mean?
Well, it seems like it happened a lot with slaves and stuff.
But it's happened lots of places. Yeah,
I'm thinking about what Hilly Dream Act.
Yes. That's the familiar U.S. case.
Yeah, right? So it seems like they didn't have money at the time to start their own farm, so the best option for them was sharecropping.
Well, except they could have rented, with the agreement being that when the crop comes in, we owe you $200, as opposed to half the crop.
But how did you know that you'd get $200 from the crop?
But what do you...
insuring yourself against the risk of only getting $100 of the crop.
That is to say, the most obvious argument is risk aversion. The obvious argument is that with a fixed rent, which gives you better incentives... But the fixed rent may mean you starve one year because your income is equal to the rent or less than the rent. So that's one explanation. Yep.
I'm obviously saying, I assume the real world, they're not far from my thing. The person has, especially if they're, you know, if they're impoverished, they want to.
Even if they're impoverished, there are a bunch of different landlords they can go to.
They can't come to someone and say, this is how we'd like our contract to be structured.
Sure they can. They can say that, and they may or may not accept it, just like anybody else.
But, I mean, if this is the way they're going to be making their money, it's their only option. They're not really.
Sure they have. Because there are a lot of different landlords.
But there's not in many places. I don't know what sharecropping is like in these other.
Well, if we go to the case of Friedman after the war, there were firms in the business of finding places where they needed labor and providing transport for ex-slaves to those places. Now, the state governments tried to prevent this, and in fact, eventually, in at least one case, won a Supreme Court case, letting them do so. It's a case where the Supreme Court was not following. That arguably the Lochner Court should have said that the states weren't entitled to regulate that business, but they in fact didn't, unfortunately. But nonetheless, it was happening on a large scale. So I'm not saying there was never any case where somebody had a monopoly, but I don't think the typical agricultural situation in the South was there only one landowner within 50 miles, and you know, people could walk 50 miles in a couple of days. Another possible explanation would be that perhaps the landlord's providing inputs other than land. You might imagine the case where the landlord is the expert, or where the landlord is lending his draft animals for pulling the plow, or the landlord is the one who knows where to sell the grain, so that you might have a case where it really is like the cases we've described of co-insurance, where you've got inputs by both parties, and consequently the optimal thing is to buy. But as I say, what's clear is that no special set of circumstances can explain it, because it's found in many different societies as a quite common arrangement. All right, let me end with the three questions that I have at the end of the chapter, which I thought are all sort of fun, and they're all legal questions, and they have to do with the way in which the law does or should, mostly does, allocate certain risks. And there are three different cases. The first one is, I'm the tenant. I'm renting something for a year. The house I'm renting burns down. Do I get to stop paying rent on it? Do you know what the common law legal rule was, and can you give arguments for what it ought to be? This is, in a way, getting back to the Posner conjecture that the common law is economically efficient. What is the argument in favor of my having to continue to pay rent on the burned down house?
Generally, the landlord doesn't live there. You have control whether or not
it burns down.
That's
right. The argument is you're the one in the best position to take precautions, and therefore we want you to bear at least a sizable. You're not going to bear all the costs, because at the end of the year you go somewhere else, but at least you're bearing a sizable part of the cost, because you're paying for a year's housing you're not getting. And that is apparently the common law rule, that the tenant was normally held. You could have contracts specified otherwise, but the default rule is the tenant was liable. The second case is risk of fraud in purchase, and that's my case where somebody comes and buys your land from you using what you later discover are gold-plated lead pieces of lead as coins, but you don't realize that until he not only has skipped town, but before skipping town has resold the land to somebody else. Can you reclaim the land? Anybody know? What should the rule be? Who is it? Of the two people left to divide the risk, namely the current owner of the land and the original owner, who is in the best position to prevent this problem? The original owner. The current owner, just there was a good title. He bought it. He never saw the original transaction of purchase. And in fact, that's the rule. That he gets a good title. You can obviously, if you can find him, you can try to sue the guy who swindled you in the beginning, but you've got no claim against the repurchaser. How about the next case, which is where he saves the trouble of making all those fake coins. He just makes a fake title deed instead. And with that fake title deed, he goes to the innocent third party and sells your land to him, and then he skips town. Now, who does the land belong to? Still to you. You had no way of preventing that. The other guy could have tried to check the title and so forth. Right. The I should say there's a somewhat analogous set of laws I don't discuss there, which have to do with the question of title to stolen property. So what happens if somebody steals your watch and then sells it to somebody else who owns it? Anybody know? I'm not sure there is a single answer. It may depend on the circumstances. It used to be the rule, I'm not sure if it still is, that if it was, that if the reselling was done in a public market in daylight in England, the buyer had good title. Presumably on the theory that it was up to you to try to keep an eye out for people selling your property there. I don't think it's true in general the buyer gets good title. And there's a long discussion in Maimonides. One of the courses I teach is this seminar on legal systems very different from ours, and I got interested in Jewish law, which turns out to be very, very well-documented ancient legal system. And Maimonides has this long discussion about when somebody steals something and sells it to someone else, under what circumstances. Under some circumstances, you get the property back, but you've got to pay the guy back what he paid the thief for it. Under other circumstances, you get the property back straight, and under some circumstances, you don't get the property back at all. And what determines that? One of the questions being whether he had the reputation of being a thief so that the second buyer should have been suspicious. Anyway, so we've finished for today. See you all Wednesday.